My name is Clay Boatwright, and I'm the board president for the Arc of Texas.
Well, I was hoping, Clay, that you could start by telling me what the problem is right now. You know, speak frankly, what is the problem with the messaging that's come out of the disability community over the last few legislative sessions?
I think the problem with the messaging is it's the exact same message that we've been delivering for the last 10 to 15 years. You know, when you look at the key takeaways or the key points that every parent and every advocate always brings out, it's always, you know, Texas is among the bottom five states in the country for supporting people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. We have 130,000 people sitting on waiting lists. The waiting lists are 8 years long. We're too reliant on our state-supported living centers. Every one of us has given that speech 40 times. We give it in our sleep. And I've started to wonder, after this number of years, is anybody listening anymore? I mean, I'm engaged in the system. I actually have a vested interest in it, and I'm not even listening to myself anymore. So I think about the audience that we're addressing it to, being the state agencies and the legislators and the general public, and I'm wondering, is it really gaining any traction? And my hypothesis is probably not. In which case, let's think of a new approach and a new way to do it.
Well, talk to me a little bit then about what the proper messaging is. I mean, you know, we've been through a couple sessions where, you know, the overarching message is we have to shut the state schools. You know, that's our primary thing. I mean, these are people who are vocal in committee hearings. You know, how do you sort of break through and people make people listen? How do you mix up or make this message sexier than it has been in the past?
Well, I think we need to get past the fact that right now, when we as family members and parents of children and adults with disabilities, and the whole system, it's all designed around delivering some sort of service. And it's almost a plug and play where you try and figure out, how do I manage this individual, not so much to enrich their life, but more to get through the day. So how do I manage through the day? How do they manage through the day? The system is trying to figure out how do we manage the system. And it's a huge system to get its arm around. So you just wind up looking at, am I providing a service in a home? Is the person living in a home that has X number of beds in it? Who cares how many beds is in a particular home? It's a strange way to raise a family. It's a strange way to enrich someone's life. We spend a lot of time worried about, are they at a state-supported living center or are they not? You know, we shouldn't care what somebody's zip code is, but that's the kind of stuff we wind up focusing on. So I think we need to back up and look at the end result and say, what is it we're really trying to shoot for and what are we trying to accomplish, which should be enriching the quality of life for people who have severe disabilities or even moderate disabilities.
So then is the message no longer about closing state schools and more about, you know, making sure people have best possible care wherever they are? Or,
you know, let's talk about the state schools for a moment. There are a group of people, and I'm the president for an organization which is pretty well known for not being in favor of the state schools. We spend a lot of breath on both sides of a group of people saying, let's close the state schools. There are equally passionate group of people, particularly those who have loved ones in our state-supported living centers, who are quite passionate about keeping them open. The issue is not the good or bad of a state school. The issue is, are the people who are living there having the best life possible, and were they able to choose across a variety of options? I'll give you a real-life example. A couple of months ago, I had a conversation with a mother who, she and her husband put their, or moved their teenage son into one of our state supporting living centers. She and I did something which is almost unheard of in the advocacy world. Between someone who is involved in an organization that is not a big fan of the state schools and a parent who is utilizing our state schools, we had a very intelligent, positive, uplifting conversation. And to be honest with you, she and I have now become friends. And through the course of that conversation, I was able to understand what issues she was facing. And I could relate to those because my wife and I have faced almost those exact same identical issues with our own children. So I knew exactly where she was coming from. What it became clear to me at the end of the conversation was the reason she and her husband made the decision to move their son to a state-supporting living center is because that was the only option that was presented to them. They did not have any other choice. Waiting 7 or 8 years for someone to come to their home to help them was not a viable option for their family. Had I been in their exact same circumstances, I don't know if I would have done anything different. So I'm not going to criticize her for making that decision. What I am going to do is urge us as a system is to figure out how do we make a variety of options available to people so they can make the right choice that's right for their family.
So how do you do this with the legislature then? If the push is not so much close the state schools and more, you know, make sure that we have all these options on the table, I mean, that sounds like going back to the waiting list discussion. I mean, what's the message to the legislature? And talk me through some, you know, some specifics.
Okay. I'm going to take you on a fairly lengthy way to get there. So I'm going to start at the very beginning, and the very beginning being that we need to completely reevaluate how we look at trying to serve the needs of people with disabilities. Because right now, the way the question you just asked me was, how do we look at our current system and tweak it? I made the comment a moment ago that we need to look at the end goal in mind. I'm going to give an analogy. I would love to own a BMW 700 series. I think that is a cool ride. The way we look at disabilities right now, using that analogy, is we say, you know what, I want a BMW 7 Series, but right now I'm driving a 5-year-old Mustang. So to get that 700 Series, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take my Mustang and I'm going to paint it. And 3 years from now, if the paint's chipped, I'm going to paint it again. And we act like if we keep painting the Mustang, then somehow or another it's going to become a BMW. That's not realistic. We need to quit looking at the system as what add-ons and adjuncts do we make to the current system to try and get to where we want to go. I think we need to completely reevaluate how we're looking at how we're serving people with disabilities. So I'm going to go to a very, very early stage and walk you through to a potential solution. I'm going to ask for some latitude. You know me, so I'm going to take some latitude here. Okay. I'm an evangelical Christian. Which means when I am in search of a solution to a problem, I'm going to go to the Bible, knowing that it is absolutely true, and say, all right, what guidance can I get from there? And the Bible has a whole bunch of references and a whole bunch of thoughts and suggestions on how we look at people with disabilities. And I'm going to give you two references to launch the discussion that I'm going to lead then to a final solution on how we need to evaluate the system. The first one comes out of Psalms 82, 3 through 4. It says, we need to defend the cause of the weak and the fatherless. We need to maintain the rights of the poor and the oppressed. We need to rescue the weak and the needy and deliver them from the hand of the wicked. You know, the Bible can be kind of complicated at times. That one's pretty easy. You know, it's pretty clear on what we need to do. Next question is, how do you do it? I'm going to lead to another Bible verse, one of my favorite, 1 Peter 4:10. Each one should use whatever gift he has received to serve others, faithfully administering God's grace in its various forms. Each one should use whatever gift he has received to serve others, faithfully administering God's grace in its various forms. My favorite phrase in that is the very opening line. Each one is code. You know what the code's for? It's for everybody. Everybody needs to be engaged in using their gifts. Let me bring that now down to our practical problem. When you look at how people with disabilities are served right now, I'm going to guess, and I'm making this number up, but I'm going to guess it's well north of 75% of the practical support that people who are able to receive disabilities, or receive support, and most people aren't, 75% or more of that comes from the state and federal government. That's why our Medicaid budget is so incredibly huge. Is because so much support is coming from the state and federal level. Now, some people would say, particularly here in Texas, a lot of people at my church would say the reason for that is we have a lot of people who are into social justice, are trying to create a large government, try and take care of everybody. That's not the case. The reason so much is coming out of the government is because nobody else is stepping up to the plate. that Bible reference, when it referred to everybody, when it referred to everyone, it didn't mean only the government needs to do it. It means everyone, each one of us needs to be involved. The reason I bring that up is there are other players who need to be coming up to the table to help serve this community. And I've developed what I call the three-legged stool for support of people with disabilities. The first stool is going to be an element of the government. You know, the government does things really well in some ways, and primarily it's providing infrastructure. When you need to build a road, the government does that pretty well. When you need to have something inspected, that's what they do really well. When we need to protect someone's civil rights or their physical well-being, that's what our government does really well. So that's their function, is to provide the infrastructure and protection. The next leg of the stool is the business community. The business community is really good at ingenuity, creativity, and bringing capital. I genuinely believe in the next 5 years, the single most important success or improvement in the lives of people with disabilities, intellectual and developmental disabilities, is going to come from a publicly traded corporation. You know who it is? Apple. When you look at the iPad right now, and I own no stock in Apple, so I get nothing out of this gig, all right? We're seeing unbelievable successes in people who basically cannot communicate orally in any way, are taking an iPad and some of the apps that are being developed for it, and are learning how to communicate in an electronic fashion in a way that nobody would have ever imagined before. That's going to be continuing to grow constantly. I mean, the successes are amazing. And when you think about it, from a societal standpoint, that's pretty cool. Look back 10 years ago, 25 years ago, we looked at people who couldn't communicate in a conventional fashion, and we said, you know what, you know, they can't speak, they can't communicate, we're going to have to communicate for them. How do we take care of them? We treat them almost like they're pets. And that's an extreme statement, but that's kind of how it was treated. When I look at my children now, my oldest daughter is 13 years old. She's a conventionally developing child. My daughter doesn't talk to anybody. You know how she communicates? Text messaging. She uses her iPhone to communicate with everybody. If her younger sisters, who cannot speak verbally, if they're learning how to communicate electronically, we now have two peers who are using the same type of device, the same type of platform to share thoughts and ideas. And isn't that what communication really is? So I think technology being inspired by the conventional or by the business community is going to give us huge inroads in there. Right now, nobody's really thinking about inviting them to the table for the discussion in a big way. And the third stool is an area which has been embarrassingly quiet in this world, and that is the faith-based community. Faith-based community is really good at mobilizing people, selling a message, getting people energized. Somewhat related to that is the nonprofit community, where, you know, in our world we can bring some expertise into play. How do we get the faith-based community, which everything I'm describing is biblically based? We're not talking heresy here. How do we get the faith-based community, the business community, and the government all together to create a totally new business model for how we're serving people with disabilities? When I think about my twins, who, as you know, have very severe disabilities, my choice should not be how many beds are in the house that I want them to live in. The question should be, unique to their needs, how can I first identify the environment for them to live in, and then through a host of technology, funding streams that may be available, volunteers who may be at play, can help them maintain a quality of life that is defined by them, not defined by the available service that happened to be available to serve them that particular Tuesday. Does that make sense? I'm going to give one little selling point here for something that the Ark of Texas is involved in. Are you familiar with something called microboards?
On a very base level, yes.
Okay. A microboard is basically a nonprofit organization set up to serve an individual. And what's neat about a micro board is you're bringing together people who have a vested interest in that person. So it's family members, it's their friends, it may be their classmates, it may be people from their church who get together and with the person develop a plan of what does that person want their life to be in terms of where do they live, what do they do for fun, where can they work if that's a possibility, how is their money managed, things of that nature. And each one of these board members takes on a certain role. They volunteer for a certain role as part of this process. The reason that is so cool is that is community in its finest. That's people, we're starting with what the individual wants and then using these natural resources available to them and around them from people who care about them, identifying how do we create that best possible environment for them. As opposed to what we have right now is mom and dad looking at how much money do I have available? Where can I plug and play a Medicaid waiver program out of the government that's going to have these type of restrictions? And is my child over 18 or under 18? Does that mean that I can be the foster parent, but I can't be the foster parent? Or is this person going to be paid? All that kind of bureaucratic junk that kind of gets in the way. And that is a sustainable business model. Or sounds weird using a term business model. A micro board environment, which really is what I was talking about a moment ago, on bringing together government resources, business resources, and faith-based resources, but doing it in a very localized way. That is a sustainable life for someone, where they are the center of that program. Right now, I think it's estimated that 75 to 85% of people with developmental disabilities live at home with their aging parents. This is going to come as a shock. Those aging parents are going to die. And that is one of the biggest fears that every parent has. When you have a child who has a fairly severe disability, it's completely unnatural for you to want to outlive your own child. Most parents don't want that. Most parents expect to pass away before their children do. There are a lot of parents who that is their biggest fear, that they die before their kids do. It's completely unnatural. When I was board president of the Ark of Dallas, I used to use this example quite a bit. It's fairly common for us to get a phone call from Parkland Hospital. It happens fairly frequently. It goes like this. Hi, this is Parkland Hospital. I'm the triage nurse in the emergency room. 85-year-old mom is laying on the gurney. 65-year-old Jim is sitting in our lobby. He can't speak. We think he may have soiled himself. What do we do? Jim's world is about to be rocked in a really big way. Now, we're grateful that Parkland thought to call us. But you know what? Jim is the one who's going to lose in this deal. He really is. Wouldn't it have been great if years earlier, Jim's parents had been able to get together with their extended family and their friends and the people from their church and so on and create an environment that with Jim leading the discussion on what his life would look like. When that happens, or when mom eventually passes away, sure, Jim will miss her, but it's not near the shock to the system he's going to have to endure. So many people go through that shock right now. And in the case of a lot of people, mom and dad die, it then goes to the siblings. I've told Blair, my oldest daughter, she's asked me, Dad, when you and mom die, am I going to be responsible for Paige and Mia? I've looked her in the face and said, no. I hope, by your own choice, that you'll want to be involved with them. She is a great big sister right now. I'm reasonably confident that she will always be on their side and will be looking out for them. That's going to be her choice. I'm not raising my daughter to know that she is going to have to be responsible for her younger sisters. That's my job. That's my gig. That's not her gig, unless it's by her choice.
Well, I have to ask you, obviously you're a businessman, you're a father, you're also deeply religious. When you bring the Bible into your message, how does it sit with the Ark? How do you feel like it sits with, the rest of the disability community? When you bring up, the faith-based community I mean, are these things that sort of jive with the existing mentality, or is this sort of a new direction?
When I brought it up, and everybody knows me, so this isn't a shocker to anybody, I think you would be surprised. I've noticed that a lot of people who maybe are not as vocal as I am will smile, and there's a certain relief. I'm not trying to turn the ARC into a Christian-based organization. The ARC is a secular organization that happens at this moment to have a board president who's a man of faith. And there are a lot of other faith-based people who work for the ARC and who are on the board. And it's not true for the ARC. This is true for a lot of what we'll call secular nonprofit organizations. And you know what? I'm okay. I think it should. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. So we're not out there trying to convert these into Christian organizations. I've never received any pushback on it. And when you think about it, what I was describing a moment ago, which for me is traces back to a Bible-based orientation, it's what? It's respecting the individual. It's providing options for people. It's trying to enrich the life of someone who, when God designed them, maybe didn't give them the full set of skills, and this was God's choice, that he gives the rest of us. And that's okay. That's what the ARC does. Is we try and create options for people, and we try to improve their quality of life. So we're landing in the same place.
I am curious what you feel like you are hearing regarding, you know, the disability community from either of the gubernatorial candidates on the campaign trail. Has there been radio silence on this issue? If so, are there particular questions you feel like you want answered?
I have heard nothing. And it's kind of funny. I follow politics like most people follow baseball and football. And I kind of keep a scorecard. You know, I look and see what are people's points of view on different things. And the scorecard on this one is pretty quiet, I think, from the two gubernatorial candidates. And I think about the question that I would like to ask them. It would be this. Texas is a good place to live. Have good weather. Our cost of living is relatively low. I understand we're open for business. We have a good infrastructure. We have a lot of good companies that are based here. So it's a lot of good stuff. So for people like you and me, Texas is not a bad place to live. My question for Governor Perry and Mayor White would be, with that understanding, and with the understanding that they have of our disability support system, and I'm going to assume that they understand our disability support system and the fact that, you know, we have recently been sued by the Department of Justice and things of that nature. If they had a severe intellectual disability, would they want to live in Texas?